Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Eureka. You're getting the gist by now. This is a show that gets under the skin of science in a good way, as we invite a new expert every week to help us answer one of science's most interesting questions, as decided by, well, it's us. Isaac Asimov once said, the most exciting phrase in science is not Eureka, but that's funny. Respectfully, you're wrong, Isaac. You can have a bit of both. I'm Rick Edwards.
And I'm Dr. Michael Brooks.
I think I'm out of not a real doctor material now.
Oh, good. Finally.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to stop saying it because, you know, who wants to listen to a show that's just Rick Edwards and Michael Brooks? I mean, we're just going to lose listeners, aren't we? And we need some kind of, you know, incentive for people to think they're getting like some kind of value for money.
Your position is that people are tuning into this show because you're a doctor.
Well, I mean,
I don't think that's true.
I don't. I think, it, you know, maybe they think, oh, I'll keep listening. You know, they've got to that point and they're like, oh, Dr. Michael Brooks, I'll keep listening.
I think you're kidding yourself.
Yeah, maybe. So what's on the agenda today then?
So at the time of recording, as you'll be aware, it's the start of Glastonbury. And I thought music is quite a good one for us to tackle and one we haven't really looked at before.
Yeah, nice. Okay. I mean, are you going to tell me your Glastonbury stories or not?
No. I think this might be the kind of situation where we spend 15 minutes of me talking about my various entertaining sort of activities at music festivals and then my agent says, no, obviously not. So I think maybe we just cut out the middleman. Now, it's been suggested by our producer that I ask you, can you play an instrument? Here we go. Can you? Yes. Do you play any music at all, Michael?
Yeah, I play the guitar and I play the bass.
Never mentioned it.
Actually, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'm absolutely adequate at both, and not really very good, I would say. I was talking to our drummer yesterday, and basically I was sort of saying, you know, I'm sort of perfectly adequate for the job in hand, but I really wish I was actually good at it, you know. But I've never put any effort into it.
You don't really need to be good as a bass player, though, do you?
No, you need to be just adequate. I mean, you need to not make mistakes, not be noticed. I mean, that's the whole point. Mm. You know, don't ask me to solo or anything like that. Obviously, I don't want to stand out. I just want to not stand out for the wrong reasons.
Do you prefer playing in Bus Monkeys or Supernatural Things? This is Michael's two bands.
Oh, what a question that is. Mm. No, I like them both. They're so different. I'm not going to choose between them.
And which band name would you say was worse? I don't think it's easy to decide that. They're both unforgivably poor. But which is worse?
I don't think they are poor. I think Supernatural Things is a great name for a funk band.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, actually, do you know what?
It's a because song. It's, there's a song.
Because it's funk.
Supernatural
yeah,
Thing, right.
Yeah. Yeah, all right. So it's Bus Monkeys. Bus Monkeys is
the worst. Partly.
Every time
we
I
were
hear
desperate.
It, makes me cringe.
We
yes, I can hear you were desperate.
But we used to be called the Happy Endings,
oh,
right?
Oh, my God.
And then there was another band like in the sort of local
How
area.
I ended up being friends with you. I shouldn't be friends with somebody who's in a band called Bus Monkeys and was formerly in a band called the Happy Endings.
Anyway, so, you know, we gave up the name and had to find something else. It's a boring story.
Do you want to ask me if I play any music?
Actually, I do. Do you? I'm not aware of any.
No. When I was...
And I do feel like if you had any ability at all, you'd have told me about it and how good you were.
I would, yeah.
Yeah, so you don't, clearly.
No, I don't. I was, well, forced, basically, to play the violin.
Oh.
By my mum.
Always a mistake.
Oh, God, I mean, A, I was very poor at it. I don't know if it's hard. I think it's probably quite hard, the violin. I'm not sure. I had no discernible talent or interest. Would skive off most of my lessons. It's just a waste of mum's money.
Never practiced, obviously.
Never practiced. Every now and again, I'd have to play like my for my mum and dad, and my poor dad would just have to sit there and be like, even as a, you know, whatever I was, like a 10-year-old,
yeah,
very aware that your dad is sitting there being like, for
barely tolerating it.
I just want to watch the telly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why is he playing a violin badly in front of me? Whatever we're doing, we're always surrounded by sound. It might be the chatter of an annoying co-worker, someone panting frantically on the running machine next to you, or, God forbid, your own private mutterings. A fair bit of the time, though, there's probably some music. All of our lives have their own soundtracks, and as humans, music is often our chosen art form to mark and remember some of life's most seismic moments. Whether we want to cry after a breakup, have an emotional first dance, get out on the town with some friends, or even just let our inner diva shine. Looking at you, Brooksy. In the world of music, there really is something for everyone. Bearing in mind it's just a collection of sounds, what is it about music that scratches that itch in our brains like nothing else seems to? Leo Tolstoy said that music is the shorthand of emotion, so that's why this week we're asking, why do humans like music? So this week we are joined by Professor Robert Zatori, who's a neuroscientist at the Montreal Neurological Institute of McGill University. And I wanted to chat with Professor Robert because of his research on the auditory system, but more specifically because he's got an emphasis on researching speech and music. And the first question I asked him was whether musical talent was innate or acquired.
Well, it's an excellent question, exactly how to define innate musicality. It can be defined in various ways, but I think almost everyone would agree that that humans share this ability to make and to enjoy music. And the reason for that is that if you look, first of all, at across human societies, all of them have something that is recognizable as music to the others. It's really very widespread. Doesn't seem to be something, you know, that only a few cultures share. But the other thing is that if you look at infants, for example, they respond to music very, very early. There's some evidence even in the womb that they might, you know, respond to rhythms. But once you have a baby that's only a few weeks old or so, they orient to music, and there's some evidence that their movements are slightly synchronized to the musical beat. This is at an age when, you know, they don't have any, obviously, any real training or anything. So it seems to be innate from that perspective, in the sense that we almost all individuals, with some exceptions, but almost all individuals have this propensity for responding to music in one way or another.
The thing that's interesting about the way that music makes us feel and sort of interacts with us is that it triggers the same kind of dopamine release as you associate with tangible pleasures like food and sex and drugs, even though it's an abstract reward, sort of at best, really. Like, you can't
listen to something that you're enjoying and you're getting, I mean, obviously there's pleasure involved. I kind of never really thought about this. So it's the same kind of pleasure reward as eating, you know, something nice.
Exactly. So it's all part of the same, you know, very ancient kind of reward circuitry that is being activated.
See, that's weird, because it's not to do with survival, is it? So normally you associate dopamine with things that are good for your survival.
Yeah. But no, it's just it's just operating in that same circuit, but doesn't have an obvious survival link.
Wow, okay. That's interesting.
Yeah. It's obviously very linked to language, and I think that's interesting. So if you look at the temporal lobe, which is kind of the language center, the left hemisphere deals with language and words, and then the right hemisphere deals with music and sound interpretation, but they're totally linked. Lots of different. It's not just one part of your brain actually that is activated and involved in listening to music. It's lots of different bits that are kind of working together. And music can, as you'd expect, I suppose, be as addictive as a drug, because it's stimulating dopamine release. So it's kind of acting in the same way that, you know, something like cocaine would.
You've clearly not been to one of my gigs.
No, that, I imagine that acts like something like Nitol. But it can, you know.
Yeah, I mean, but can you be addicted to music?
I mean, I'd sort of say no. I think that something can be addictive, as in use the same sort of neural pathways.
Yeah.
Without you actually being addicted to it.
Yeah, okay, good.
I guess.
Do say the rhythm's going to get you.
Yeah. Just going to ignore that. But what we can see is that music can impact brain function and behaviour. It can reduce stress. It can reduce pain levels. It can actually reduce
pain levels.
Yeah. Yeah, it can reduce symptoms. We'll talk about some of the mad effects of music on animals later, okay. Obviously, because I like
I'm excited
that
for that.
It can reduce symptoms of depression. It can improve your cognitive and motor skills. Like it's really, it can even, this, when I read this, I had to read it, I think, three times just to be sure I was reading it correctly. It can even assist with neurogenesis. So your brain creating new neurons.
No.
Yes.
So all those times you're listening to music when you're revising for exams and your parents come in and say, you've got to turn that off. You won't have music in your exam. You need to have silence to concentrate. Might not be true.
Might not be true. I feel like it probably is a problem, though, because it's probably distracting.
Yeah.
Depends on the type of music.
He's like, Mum, I'm making new neurons here.
But if you think about, so what function might music have been playing in early human communities?
Yeah.
And one of the things that we know that marks us out from other primates, for example, is that we are able to socialize in large, very large groups, much larger than other primates. And one idea is that actually music allows you to bond more quickly than other forms of communication. And also specifically when time is short, when you don't have time for a load of one-on-one interactions.
Yeah.
Just the act of singing together or music, listening together, can do that. And they've kind of shown this experimentally. And they didn't, when they did the experiment, it was surprising because they thought they were going to find one thing and they found something slightly different. So they did these sort of adult education classes with groups of adults. And they had one group, and I think they were 7 months long for all three groups. One group was doing singing. One group was doing creative writing and one group was doing some sort of crafts like pottery.
I mean, you said that with such disdain.
Yeah, well, yeah, like as in the short straw. Yeah, and you've got pottery. Fucking 7 months. Oh, my God. And then they at various points along the way, they kind of spoke to people about, you know, how they were getting on with the group. And what they found is the singing group bonded really quickly. So even after the first session, people felt like that they were kind
brilliant,
of,
right, yeah,
you know, getting on with people. Yeah. But surprisingly, that didn't maintain. So by the end of the 7 months, all three activities, all three classes were bonded at about the same amount.
Oh.
So what it seems is that singing is just really good for quickly bonding groups.
But
you
then,
can see why that would
but
be.
Then it doesn't really develop after that.
Doesn't particularly develop after that, but then it is also maintained. It's not like you're less bonded.
Yeah, okay.
So, and that makes sense because then it's just a question of you're just spending time and you're kind of getting to know people over a period of, you know, period of classes. So, so that's one thing that seems to be plausible as a reason.
Yeah, so this is why people join choirs and stuff, isn't it?
It's
a great social activity and you immediately make friends.
Yeah. You know, just that sense of connection is something that we actively seek out, and you can definitely get it through music. So I thought I should probably ask Professor Robert what he thought about music as a social bonding tool.
I think music is inherently bonding, also in the sense that even if you're not with anyone else, you may listen to music and feel more connected to some group of people that aren't even there. So if this is a very common thing, if you move from your home country to somewhere else and you feel kind of lonely and you miss your friends or your cultural links, you might listen to music from your home country and suddenly you feel a much stronger connection, even though there's no one else in the room with you. So I think there are these sort of sociocultural aspects that are bound up with the music.
We all kind of know it, don't we, that there's something about music. It's like you make a mixtape for somebody and, if they like it, you feel sort of, like you've done something great there and, they might keep it for it. I mean, I've got mixtapes that are literally decades old. Still got them. I've got nothing to play them on. But, there's that kind of sense of music, like, you can't throw that away because that's, that's almost a link to that person. So, I can understand that, it just makes us bond music in so many different ways.
Have you got mixtapes from ex-girlfriends?
No. No.
Have
no,
you?
No, I haven't.
Okay.
I haven't.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
All from Philippa?
No. Actually from Philippa's brother. So I'm that sounds very weird. But when we went away to Guinea-Bissau, so we lived in West Africa for a couple of years, he sent us mixtapes of what was going on in the music scene.
Oh, that's quite cool.
Mid-90s, which we were completely missing out on. Mm-hmm. And so he just sent us these mixtapes of all the stuff that was sort of happening. And I've still got them. I can't throw them away. And every time I find something I can listen to them on, I put them on. And it's just like evocative of so much stuff about how grateful we were to hear about that and, and to get that stuff. And the sort of effort that he put into it. So
I've now got an image of you and Philippa sort of dancing around Guinea-Bissau, singing Common People.
It was that era.
It's that sort of thing, isn't
it? Yeah. So it was Blur, Oasis, that kind of Mazzy Star. Yeah. Some great stuff there.
People have also done these quite weird experiments, I think, where they've tried to work out what the sort of enjoyment is when you go and watch live music versus listening to recorded music. And so what they did is they measured people's head movements, because sort of head bobbing is quite a good proxy for how like into something you are, how much you're enjoying it. Mm. And so they measured head movements on a group of people at a gig, and then they did the same group of people, but just listening to a recording of the same artist.
Yeah.
And they found that people were more into it when it was live. And they thought that that's partly because live stuff is less predictable, and we quite like a sort of an odd combination of familiarity and novelty. Really get off on something. I know that I like this, and that's a bit surprising. Frisson.
So they've done something interesting with the song here.
Yeah, whereas I guess if you listen to a recording, pretty much like you know what's coming up on the album.
Yeah. I mean, live is also multi-sensory, isn't it? So you've got a bit more...
There's a visual element as well. Yeah. And you can see other people around you also enjoying it, and that's kind of quite infectious.
It's kind of interesting that, you're doing those studies, and presumably a lot of the studies are done with live instruments and sort of acoustic, probably, maybe sort of classical instruments or something. But I think a lot of the music that we listen to now is sort of electronic. There's like tech stuff involved. So, I mean, I wonder if that's sort of changing. And also, people are there at raves or rather than, just watching a festival, they're involved in many levels, aren't they? In that, you can be on drugs and have a new appreciation for music and sort of, it's more than just like, oh, here's a nice bit of music and lovely intervals between those notes kind of thing. It's a much bigger thing than that.
Yeah. I mean, this isn't our drugs episode, but there certainly have been studies into the relationship between drugs and music. And we'll get into that, as well as why some people literally just don't like music, right after this break.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And we're back. So historically, there has always been a culture between drugs and certain types of music. So if you look at something like LSD, it enhances sort of music evoked emotions. But there's a really interesting bit of sort of brain function in here. So there's a part of the brain that I don't think I can say the name of it. It's not rude. I just don't think I can say it. I don't think I can pronounce it.
Please try.
Yeah. Okay. It's something like the locus coeruleus. I'd never heard of it. You know, you sort of think, I know the parts of the brain. I looked at that. I was like, nope, got nothing on that. But it's the bit of the brain that detects novelty. We really like novelty,
yeah.
And we also like familiarity. And so if you get that sort of sweet spot where it's familiar and a bit novel, we love that. And some drugs activate the same, so psychedelic drugs, I think it is actually, activate that part of the brain so that it's as if you've never heard this thing before. So that explains, if you're on a psychedelic, why you put something on that you absolutely know this song, but it takes on this whole new meaning. Like, you've got to listen to this. This is the best song ever.
Yeah.
And it's because the novelty part of your brain is kind of firing and going, well, this is so new and cool and exciting.
And so how much of that do you think is responsible for the Beatles' success?
I mean, I'm not a massive Beatles fan, so I'm happy to put it all at the door of psychedelics.
Yeah. Let's do that.
And then there's other drugs. So like cannabis. Like, cannabis has a and it doesn't work with all cannabis, because it's, you know, sort of the makeup of cannabis is fairly complicated. But basic weed can allow you to sort of focus quite intensely.
Yeah.
So that's why it has a relationship with sort of meditation and mindfulness and yoga, historically and now, I suppose. And that means you just pay more attention to the music. And so you might therefore get more out of it because you're focused. So there's all sorts of reasons that drugs are associated with different types of music.
So is music like sex in that we humans aren't the only ones enjoying it? You remember our sexuality episode where we have to stop and Google?
Ah, the short-nosed fruit bat.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Horny.
Fellatio everywhere.
So, are you asking, are we the only ones who are enjoying it?
Are animals enjoying music?
Well, you know, I'm borderline obsessed with cool things animals do. So obviously, I asked Professor Robert this.
It's not very clear whether other animals enjoy sounds the way we do. For one thing, you know, the sounds that we make as music are created by us, for us, and different animal species have very different auditory systems, for instance. So, you know, I was mentioning rats before. Well, they hear very, very high frequencies that we're not even sensitive to. And the same is true of other species. So it seems very unlikely to me that music that we make would be relevant to them in any particular way. There are some interesting findings that some species of animals, like certain kinds of cockatoos, will move in time to music, in time to human music, and that's very interesting. But it seems like the animals do that because they're very social animals. They like to do things that please their owners, and so maybe by moving to the music, the owner finds that pleasurable and likes it and gives the animal, you know, strong positive feedback, and it may be linked to that. This sort of behavior has never been observed in the wild. So, you know, parrots or cockatoos do not sing and dance with each other in the jungle. So they do it only with humans.
I was a bit disappointed with Robert's answer. So I was like, going to do some of my own research, see what I come up with. Because I just
the guy spent an entire lifetime building a career on this. Yeah. And you thought, now I'm going to Google it.
I could have a look, see what I could dig up. I just thought there's going to be some other animals that are dancing. And so I just made a list.
Of nice
things that animals are doing with music. And some of them are fantastic. So, first up, mosquitoes.
What?
So this is not, by no means am I saying mosquitoes are enjoying music, but if you play dubstep to mosquitoes, so if you bang on the Skrillex, then they will eat less, as in they'll bite you less, and they'll have sex less. So the idea is that you could potentially use that as a sort of means of preventing the spread.
So forget your citronella candles, bang on the dubstep.
Exactly, because they think the dubstep just disrupts some of the kind of the like low frequency buzzing that makes part of their of their courtship.
Yeah.
And so it just basically just really pisses them off. I'm trying to get jiggy here. I can't. Yeah. I can't.
It's a male mosquito can't make his move.
Yeah. Exactly. So I like that. So that's just an effect of a type of music.
I like that.
That I thought was quite good. Cats. Now, cats pretty much seem to ignore human music. Like they just don't pay any attention to it whatsoever. But people have made specific music for cats.
Cat owners will do anything, won't they?
Yeah, exactly. I say that. People are like me. I've done this for Tippy. So they have a kind of the same tempo as purring. There's kind of some sounds like the sound of suckling when they're young. And if you play that, I don't know what it sounds like. I mean, probably awful. But cats like it. So cats will purr, cats will go over to the speaker, cats will kind of rub themselves up against the speaker. So
obviously we're going to link to this on Twitter, aren't we, when this episode comes out. Yeah. We've got to get some of that music out there.
Yeah, we have, yeah. But I like the fact that cats, it's not that they don't like music, they just don't like our music.
Yeah, no, fair enough.
Like this stuff is gash. give me some of the sweet purring suckling. I'm in. Robert mentioned cockatoos has been able to keep beat.
Yeah.
They can. So can sea lions. Oh. And there's a lovely video of a sea lion keeping beat that I really enjoyed. This one I think is am I skeptical? I think I'm slightly skeptical. So as a study done in 2001 of a herd of, like a decent sized herd of cows, like 1,000 cows.
Yeah.
And they found that if you play them slower music, so, you know, sort of Beethoven or REM or something, then they will produce more milk.
Right, I think I might have read about that.
I think you probably did. I mean, it's been knocking around for a while. I looked at the difference in volumes, and I couldn't help thinking that's not very much. Like, I wondered if it was statistically significant.
Yeah.
But I like the idea. And the kind of the theory of it is that, you know, slow tempo music will just kind of relax them.
Okay. In the Who same sponsored way that the research? It, was it Classic FM?
Yeah, well, no, it was Classic FM along with... Who's a big dairy brand? Clover. Yeah. Clover still knocking around. But you know, so if you play humans Mozart, it will it kind of affects the hypothalamus, which is the kind of regulation center that kind of sets all of the rhythms and paces of the body, and you can see it like reduces your heart rate and it reduces your blood pressure.
Is that proper research? I mean, I've read that stuff and I've never been very convinced that the effects are going to be that replicable.
I think a lot of people have looked at them and it does seem to... I think when you look at the activity of the brain, so you whack someone in an fMRI scanner, you can see that it is firing in the hypothalamus.
Right.
When you play that kind of music.
But it wouldn't...
But it wouldn't if you played it like... Coldplay. Like death metal or something.
Yeah, well, death metal is not an equivalent, is it? That's not a fair comparison.
No, but I'm just like... No, but I'm saying like a fast-paced, loud... But you're just looking for an effect from a type of music, aren't you?
Yeah.
And so you want something that's almost like the opposite to try and...
Yeah, but what I'm saying is you don't want to give Mozart special credit, do you?
Oh, like, no, sorry, I'm not... No, sorry. I was giving Mozart as an example of slow-paced classical music.
Yeah.
Like REM would do it just as well.
Yeah, yeah.
But anything, or like Enya.
Oh.
I reckon.
Imagine being stuck in an fMRI machine and then somebody puts Enya on. It's like, so cruel.
And actually, speaking of Enya, so primates, there's been quite a lot of research.
What are you saying about Enya?
I'm about to tell you. Chimps like Enya and they like Pavarotti. So all primates, pretty much, if you give them control of the radio, effectively, I mean not sort of tuning into different stations, I don't think, but if you let them have control over whether there's music playing or not,
yeah,
they quite like playing music, not the whole time, but like half of the time they like having it on.
Okay.
And you'll see that they reduce sort of unusual behaviors and like pacing and things that we think mean that they're not happy.
It seems to de-stress them.
Yeah.
Wow. And
chimps, it seems they like Enya and Pavarotti. Bonobos like sort of oldies from the 1950s. And a certain type of monkey that I didn't write down likes Michael Bolton. And so immediately you got a great image of just a sort of a crowd of monkeys and then Michael Bolton just performing and the monkeys just absolutely like having the time of their life, throwing shit at him.
Is it because when he had long hair, he looked a bit like Tarzan?
To be fair, I don't think any of the experiments have been done with Michael Bolton there.
That needs to be rectified.
It does. Again, if you're listening, Michael, get in touch. We'll get you down the zoo, son. I think that might be me. That might be my list of animals.
So inconclusive. Yeah. I mean, you have not overturned Professor Roberts' research.
No, I haven't. All I was looking for was just some fun stuff to do with animals and music. And I think I delivered.
He's put his whole career on hold now. It's like, oh, I've got it all so wrong. Rick's shown me.
But I think that... Animals don't create music themselves, as far as we can tell. So the stuff that we would think of as being music, like songbirds, is just their communication.
Well, whale song. I suppose that's communication as well.
That's communication as well, yeah. So that's closer to language. But as I said at the start, language and music are very, very closely linked.
Yeah.
So, but music does clearly have some effect, maybe small effects, on animal behaviour.
Yeah, okay.
So,
we'll mark that down as,
don't give up.
You might not be wrong, Professor Robert.
Yeah, keep at it, I reckon.
So from my perspective, a lot of what animals hear is probably rhythms, and they're basically responding to rhythmic stimuli. Would that be fair?
Yeah, I think it probably is quite fair. I want to talk about something else, but before I do that, I just in the course of my extensive research trying to prove Professor Robert wrong, actually not in that bit. I came across a few bits of information that I found staggering and had never heard before, and I thought you would enjoy. So the first one is there's another bit of brain that I'd never heard of called the putamen.
All right.
Heard of that?
No, never.
No, nothing. Apparently, this is the bit of the brain that processes rhythm and regulates kind of body movement and coordination.
Okay, yeah.
And because music increases dopamine levels in there, it can, in human patients, temporarily stop the symptoms of Parkinson's disease.
What?
So it can sort of act like a cane. So suddenly, someone with Parkinson's who wasn't able to get up out of their chair,
yeah,
play them the right bit of music, and up they get.
What kind of music does that?
And then the music, I don't know that.
Ugh.
But actually, it might just be any music that they like, because you're just trying to get dopamine levels up.
Right, yeah.
But isn't that bad?
Yeah, that is.
But as soon as you turn the music off, curtains.
Oh, no.
But, yeah.
I mean, I feel like that's sad, and equally could be a great party game.
So what? I mean, it certainly gives musical chairs.
Sort of like musical chairs with a new twist.
Different flavour.
Yeah.
So that was good, I thought. Also, the ear only has 3,500 inner hair filaments. And that is taking care of hearing for you.
Yeah.
When you compare that to the fact that your eyes have got 100 million photoreceptors, your ears are doing a pretty good job.
Yeah, and you don't want to lose those.
Not particularly, no. And which was a good segue. I'm going to give you one more fact. I'm lucky. maybe you knew this. Maybe this is my ignorance. We're born with more neurons than we need. And around the age of 8, you start to dump the ones that are sort of deemed to be unnecessary. And that is why it's so much easier to learn music and languages and things like that, or anything, when you're a kid.
Wow.
And then gradually the brain's like, well, you didn't use those, so off they go.
So your violin neurons have gone.
Yeah. Well, I was like, that again is quite a weird system. I mean, I guess maybe it's efficient.
Do you think we've always lost them? Or do you think there was at some point in our evolutionary history where you didn't lose them because you actually used much more of them for tasks that had to be done, and now we're sort of,
we're just having to do different tasks now, aren't we?
Yeah,
it's not like we're doing less, just different. So presumably, it's just a way of maximizing the efficiency of what you've got. You don't want to be running like a system that's got a load of bits that are never get used.
So it's like clearing out the cache.
Yeah.
All right. So we can both hear fine. Enjoy music, but I know that deaf people enjoy music as well. So is that about sort of sensing other than through the ears? Or, is that the kind of, again, I guess rhythms come through very strongly, and probably bass.
Yeah. So bass in particular, but vibrations and feel and touch end up being processed by exactly the same part of the brain.
Yeah.
So you would think, right, your auditory cortex is not going to get any messages in a deaf person, because you think, well, that's the whole point. But they do. They're just coming from a different place.
Yeah.
So it's processed. Yeah. So therefore, a deaf person's relationship with music can end up being really quite similar to someone who's got perfect hearing, because it's being processed in the same place.
Okay. I mean, that's interesting, because I was reading an interview with Tasha from Love Island, who is deaf and is a dancer.
Yeah.
Right. So you'd think, oh, you know, maybe that's not, you know, the obvious career, but actually for her, from, you know, from what she says, it's absolutely, you know, fine. No issues.
Because what you'll have is that the sort of, like, the emotional connection that you might have with music, someone who's deaf can still have that. They'd just be recognizing it from the bass notes or the beat,
yeah,
rather than the higher pitched melody,
yeah,
which is probably what you or I would latch
yeah,
on to.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's just kind of it's sound, but being just not being processed by the ear, but then being sent to the same bit of the brain, and so having a lot of the same effects on brain chemistry and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, that's good.
Mm.
The thing I don't get is why some people just say, no, I don't really like music.
So actually, I put this to Professor Robert and asked him about people who just cannot enjoy music.
Musical anhedonia is actually something that we discovered with my colleagues here in Barcelona, actually, at the University of Barcelona, because it had been assumed, I'm talking about, you know, 10 years ago or so, the assumption then was that essentially everyone likes music. But we started sort of digging into it, and we found that that's not necessarily true. There are some people who have perfectly normal hearing, they have perfectly normal, cognitive abilities, perfectly normal social lives, but they just report that they don't get enjoyment from music. And when we interviewed them, there aren't so many of them, but it's maybe 1 or 2% of the population. And when we interview them, they say, yeah, you know, all my friends or all my family, they're always telling me to listen to music because it's so wonderful, but it just doesn't give me any pleasure. I don't see what the fuss is all about. You know, I could live without it and it makes no difference. And when we put those folks into a brain scanner, we found that indeed, the reward part of the brain that I was talking about earlier, the parts of the brain that respond to pleasurable stimuli, were not active to music, but they were active in other domains. For example, we had them do like a video game that involves winning some money. And when they did that game, their reward system was lighting up just like everyone else. So there's nothing wrong with their reward system. It's just that the input to the reward system from the auditory part of the brain, the part that processes the musical sounds, that input is somehow much weaker than it is in the average person.
There was a scientific, I don't know if it was quite a consensus, but certainly an idea for a long time that we were hardwired to like a certain type of sound. So there's two, I mean, as a musician, of course, you'll know this, two basic type of sounds. So consonant sounds and then dissonant sounds.
Yeah.
And so consonant sounds are just like the sort of mathematically perfect ones. So when it's like an octave, lovely, just sounds good. It tends to sound kind of brighter and more final. And then dissonant sounds just sound kind of harsh and sort of unfinished. And the classic is the theme tune of The Simpsons. Like that ends on a dissonant sound, and it's quite like it's amazing. It's kind of iconic, but it's also I don't know what the effect you would.
Well, it's designed to sort of discomfort you.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, it is discomforting, isn't it?
Yeah.
And people thought, well, that must just be something about us, and the kind of the maths of it. You kind of it sort of made a bit of sense. You go, we obviously just we like this and we don't like this, and obviously musicians have played around with this idea a great deal. But then they did a test with this Amazonian tribe. So, and this is a tribe who'd had no exposure to Western music at all. And they played them all sorts of different sounds, consonant and dissonant, and they had no preference.
Oh, really?
Just like they'd like some of them, they didn't like them, but there was no discernible. Whereas when you do it with, say, like a group of American students,
they like the
consonant, they don't like the dissonant. So that really tells you. And then I think they did another group that was sort of like a group of people who lived in Bolivia that was sort of like a halfway house. They'd heard a little bit of, but not much Western music. And they were, their results were roughly in the middle. So they kind of preferred the consonant sounds, but didn't
hate the dissonant.
But didn't really hate the dissonant sound. And so that says This is a learned behavior.
Yeah.
This is not innate. And this is what I was, yeah, this is what I wanted
to. And it's not to do with the mathematical perfection or anything like that.
No.
These octaves and you know, perfect sort of numbers from the Greeks and all that kind of stuff.
No. So what we think it may have been, actually, and just kind of right back to the start, is when we first started to make musical instruments, like these shitty little bone pipes, yeah. It would have just been easier to play consonant sounds. And I just think all of these instruments, would have been playing consonant sounds. And that will be to do with physical properties.
Yeah.
So I guess it is slightly related. And that's what we've kind of, in evolutionary history,
yeah,
over thousands of years, that's kind of what we've grown up listening to.
So you can imagine if somebody was evenly spacing the holes on their bone flute,
yeah,
that would give you a series of notes that actually were more likely to be consonant than dissonant.
Than dissonant, yeah.
Just because of the mathematical, physical, yeah, or the physical properties of that. So that's maybe what you get used to. So whereas the goon that had the kind of holes all over the place.
Yeah. People are like, what's
A,
that
it was really hard to play
hard
properly.
Hard to play, yeah.
Yeah, because your fingers are evenly spaced, aren't they? So, oh God, that's amazing. I love that.
Yeah, yeah. But the idea that it's, the idea it's learned behaviour, you wouldn't have thought that, would you?
No.
But it seems it is. So our question for this episode, why do humans like music? Obviously, I asked Professor Robert.
At one level, I believe the answer has to do with the biology of our nervous system. We have structures in the brain which have evolved over millions and millions of years to signal the presence of important, salient, and pleasurable stimuli. And as humans, we not only respond to very biologically pleasurable stimuli, like let's say food, but we also respond to very abstract, complex stimuli, including artistic stimuli, and of course music, I would argue, is one of the most highly developed of those. Hearing music where you expect something to happen and what happens is something a little bit different that the musician is giving you. They're either giving you a slightly different chord, or they're prolonging a cadence, or they're changing the rhythm so that it's a little bit more offbeat. That's when music gives us the greatest pleasure, is when you're expecting something to happen and what happens is actually better than what you expected. And that's when you get the biggest dopamine boost in your reward system. And I believe that's when we experience the greatest pleasure.
It's basically music is a drug.
Yeah.
And it's made better by taking certain drugs.
Yeah.
Because it's just doing that chemical thing.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, it has to have had an important role at some point in our revolutionary past.
Yeah, sure.
Because otherwise, you wouldn't just have something weirdly acting on your reward circuit for no reason, I don't think.
No, but it wouldn't
get selected for, would it?
But it's a stimulus. It's like touch, isn't it? Or
you're like, I know why that's useful, because it's telling me something about my environment. Music isn't telling me anything about my environment. It's not keeping me safe. It's not allowing me to eat more. It's not like it's not performing any tangible function.
It's just the bonding.
It's just pleasure. But I think bonding is the
shared pleasure.
Yeah, shared pleasure, which enables shared pleasure, which facilitates bonding with large groups of people, which is definitely useful.
Yeah,
if you look at the way that human society has evolved.
Okay,
good old music.
That's marvellous.
I've warmed slightly to music over the course of this episode. I came away from it thinking, do you know what? Maybe music's not so bad after all.
Eureka is a Stack production presented by Dr. Michael Brooks and Rick Edwards. The production team is Temi Adebayo, Katie Baxter, Luke Moore and Charlie Morgan. Sound design by Katie Baxter. Special thanks to today's expert, Professor Robert Zatori. Please subscribe and rate wherever you listen to your podcast. It does make a massive difference. We also really love hearing from you guys. So if you have any burning questions you want us to answer, drop us an email at eureka@stack.london. Or you can find us, as always, on Twitter at EurekaPod. Thanks.
As I was reading the bit about a breakup, crying after a breakup, I remembered that after I broke up with my first girlfriend, I was very sad. I listened to one song on repeat for, I think, 3 days. Wow. Realistically, and just around and round and round and round and round. And now, on the very rare occasions that I hear that song, immediately get like a shudder.
Really? A shudder of sort of just like, that was a terrible time, or it just evokes that emotion.
Bit of both, I think. Yeah.
And interesting,
isn't it? Inextricably linked. Like, there's no way I can hear that song without thinking of that, but not really.
What song was it?
You'll never guess it. It's a one-hit wonder, actually. Eagle Eye Cherry, Save Tonight.
I know that. Quite. Save tonight.
Yeah, don't do it. Don't do it.
Tomorrow will
don't
be
do it.
Gone.
Don't do it to me.
Come tomorrow.
Yes, you know it. And so you're not
just
the
trying to make you shudder.
You're not the singer, you say. Okay, interesting. Or a nice message from Katie. Can this go as an Easter egg at the end of the episode? Yes, it can. Absolutely. Probably cut out before Brooksy starts singing.
Eureka is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.